You're listening ad-free on Wondery Plus. It's June 15th, 1963, in the city of Jackson, Mississippi. John Doerr, a 41-year-old lawyer, is one of the few white faces in a predominantly black procession of 5,000 mourners. They're accompanying a hearse through the quiet streets, carrying the casket of civil rights leader Medgar Evers, who was assassinated in Jackson 3 days ago. The marchers are all silent, except for the occasional sob of grief. But as they near a predominantly white part of town, the number of police officers lining the route increases, and the somber procession comes to a sudden stop. John pushes forward through the crowd until he reaches the front and sees why the mourners have halted. The road is blocked by police officers. Dogs strain at their leashes, and a fire truck idles behind the barricade, ready to turn its hose on the mourners. As the procession edges closer to the police line, one of the officers swings his baton and catches a mourner in the head. This assault sparks the rest of the officers to jump in, and a black man screams as he's hit by the butt of a rifle and is dragged behind the police line. Fearing for their safety, other mourners near the front try to get away from the police, but they're pressed forward by the crowd behind, and there's nowhere for them to go. Some of the mourners fling bottles and rocks at the police as the melee grows, but this only enrages the cops and makes them swing harder. John Doerr realizes that the clash could lead to deaths and cause a race riot. Hoping that the officers won't attack a white man like him, John steps between the police and the mourners, holding his hands up high. He pleads with the crowd to stop, yelling that Medgar Evers wouldn't want it this way. The crowd steps back, and a space begins to open up between the mourners and the police. John breathes a sigh of relief as the procession retreats, but the line of officers and their dogs and batons seems impenetrable. The mourners will have to find a different route to their final destination. A few days after Medgar Evers' funeral, FBI agents investigating his murder identified a prime suspect. But justice will only be served after three trials and 30 years have passed when Byron Della Beckwith will finally be convicted for the brutal killing of Medgar Evers on February 5, 1994. From Noiser and Airship, I'm Lindsey Graham. And this is History Daily. History is made every day. On this podcast, every day, we tell the true stories of the people and events that shaped our world. Today is February 5th, 1994. The long-awaited conviction of Medgar Evers' killer. It's a summer evening in 1934 in Decatur, Mississippi, 29 years before the assassination of civil rights leader Medgar Evers. Medgar is only 8 years old, strolling down the street with his older brother Charles. Medgar and his family live a few miles out of town, and to the young farm boy, Decatur seems like a bustling metropolis. But though Medgar is still inexperienced in many ways of the world, he knows enough that a black child like him needs to be careful, even this close to home. Although the 13th Amendment after the American Civil War ended slavery 69 years ago, blacks in the South remain second-class citizens. So-called Jim Crow laws have institutionalized racial segregation, meaning black people can't use white restrooms or drinking fountains. They can't visit white stores or restaurants. And they certainly can't go into white neighborhoods after dark for fear of being lynched, something the white police force hardly ever considers a crime. But right now, it's still light out, and Medgar and his brother have the run of downtown Decatur while their parents are off on errands. As Medgar and Charles explore, they spot a crowd of people by the courthouse and wander over to investigate. The curious boys weave through the adults to the front and discover a man speaking through a bullhorn. Medgar recognizes the man from the newspaper. It's Theodore Bilbo, the former governor of Mississippi, who's now campaigning to win a seat in the U.S. Senate. So with nothing else to do, Medgar and Charles sit on the courthouse steps to listen, but they soon wish they hadn't. When Theodore spots the two black boys, he sees an opportunity to win over the predominantly white audience. He singles out the children, and Megner feels the hostile eyes of everyone in the crowd turn toward him. Theodore spits out racist slurs as he warns the crowd that if they don't vote for him, one day these two black boys sitting on the steps before them will be running the place. Megner's cheeks flush with embarrassment and shame, but those feelings are soon replaced by determination, a desire to fight back against racists like Theodore and change Mississippi for the better. 8 years later, Megner is further inspired to improve the lot of black Americans by his experience as a soldier. When World War II breaks out, Megner drops out of high school to join the Army. He takes part in the D-Day landings as part of an all-black battalion and is surprised to be greeted by the white people of France as a hero. He discovers that Europe does not have racial segregation laws, and he and his comrades enjoy freedoms there that they don't have back in southern states like Mississippi. But Mississippi is still Megner's home, and he isn't prepared to abandon it. So after he's demobilized from the Army, Megner enrolls at an all-black college. He meets and marries Merle Beasley and gains a job as an insurance salesman. And as Megner builds a happy home, he makes good on his promise to fight racism. He becomes the field secretary of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, or NAACP, and he drives thousands of miles all across Mississippi, registering black people to vote. He sets up new regional chapters of the NAACP. He organizes a boycott of gasoline stations that bar blacks from using restrooms. And in the coastal city of Biloxi, Megner helps an effort to desegregate public beaches. But Megner's increasingly prominent role in the civil rights movement makes him a target for vengeful white supremacists. Among them is a resident of nearby Greenwood, Mississippi, Byron Della Beckwith. As a member of the White Citizens Council, Beckwith is a staunch supporter of racial segregation. He hands out racist pamphlets in the streets and encourages other white people to support segregationist policies. When the Montgomery bus boycott of 1956 leads to new federal laws banning segregation on public transport, Beckwith leads a counter-protest and tries to block black passengers from entering Greenwood's bus terminal. But Beckwith's efforts have little effect, and then, on June 11, 1963, his segregationist ideology suffers another blow. On that day, President John F. Kennedy will deliver a nationally televised speech calling for Congress to pass new civil rights legislation. With southern states coming under increased pressure to end segregation, Beckwith will decide he must take more radical action. On the same night as Kennedy's speech, Beckwith will hide outside Megner Evers' house with a rifle, waiting to commit a cold-blooded murder for which he will evade justice for the next 30 years. It's the early hours of June 12, 1963, at the home of Megner Evers in Jackson, Mississippi, 6 hours after President John F. Kennedy delivered a speech calling for greater racial equality. 30-year-old Merle Evers yawns as she watches television with her children. Her husband Megner has been putting in such long hours for the NAACP that their children hardly ever get to see him. So tonight, Merle's told her two older boys that they can stay up late and greet their father when he comes home. A little after midnight, Merle hears Megner's car pulling into the driveway. But before her children can see their father, a single gunshot echoes through the quiet night. The boys instinctively drop to the floor, just as their parents have taught them to do if they hear a gun being fired. Merle runs outside and finds Megner lying face down in the driveway, his arm reaching toward the house with his keys in his hand. He's been shot in the back, and blood is pooling beneath him. Megner is still alive when an ambulance rushes him to a nearby hospital, but it's a white-only facility, and his treatment is delayed when the emergency room staff initially refuse to admit him. They only give way when they're told that the patient is a prominent civil rights campaigner, and allowing him to die at their door could lead to a race riot. But the doctors aren't able to save Megner. The bullet passed through his heart, and he dies less than an hour after reaching the hospital. News of Megner's assassination travels quickly and far. In Washington, D.C., an immediate FBI investigation has begun, and it's not long before there's a breakthrough. A few days after the murder, agents discover an Enfield rifle in the bushes across the street from Megner's home. On its own, the weapon is not much of a clue. This type of weapon was used by American soldiers in World War I, and there are millions of them in the country. But the scope of the rifle is a different matter. It's a rare Japanese model, and it soon traced back to a potential owner, Byron Della Beckwith. Agents take Beckwith's fingerprints, and they match those found on the gun. On the basis of such strong evidence, Beckwith is arrested and charged with Megger's murder. 7 months later, District Attorney Bill Waller enters a courtroom on the first day of Beckwith's murder trial. Like most lawyers in Mississippi, Bill is white. So is the judge and every member of the jury. Regardless, Bill presents the facts of the case, certain that the evidence against Beckwith should be enough for a conviction. But the defense casts doubt over the fingerprint on the gun's scope, pointing out that the expert witness who matched it gained his qualification from a correspondence course. The defense attorney goes on to suggest that the gun may have been planted to frame Beckwith. He calls witnesses who testify they saw Beckwith at a gas station across town at the time of the murder. Bill knows he needs to shore up his case, so when Beckwith takes the stand, Bill tries to draw him into making racist comments, but although Beckwith voices his support for segregation, he keeps his cool, and enough doubt is planted in the jury's mind that they cannot come to a decision. The judge declares a mistrial. 2 months later, Bill returns to court to lead the prosecution of Beckwith a second time, but Bill realizes he's fighting an uphill battle when a key prosecution witness changes his story. In the first trial, a cab driver testified that Beckwith had asked him for directions to Megger's house only a few days before the murder. Now, the cab driver is unsure whether it was Beckwith he spoke to. Later, Bill discovers that the cab driver was savagely beaten by the Ku Klux Klan for his testimony in the first trial, and that is likely why he changed his story. Bill is unable to build a case convincing enough for the all-white jury to convict, and they end up deadlocked again. The judge declares a second mistrial, and Bill senses that he'll likely never secure a conviction. He chooses not to pursue the case further. So after 10 months in jail, Byron Della Beckwith is set free. On reaching his home in Greenwood, Mississippi, Beckwith's neighbors will line the streets holding up welcome home banners and waving Confederate flags. A year later, Beckwith will join the Ku Klux Klan and give a speech at a rally boasting about killing a black person. But Beckwith's habit of gloating will come back to haunt him during his third and final trial for murder, when justice will finally be done for Megger Evers. It's spring 1991 at Arlington National Cemetery in Washington, D.C., 27 years after Byron Della Beckwith was twice tried for Megger Evers' murder. Merle Evers dabs tears from her eyes as a cemetery worker digs up the grass before Megger's tombstone. Almost 3 decades after Merle came to Arlington for her husband's funeral, she's now back to witness the exhumation of his body. In the years that followed Megger's assassination, Merle wrote her husband's biography and continued his work in the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. Recently, with a new generation of judges on the bench in Mississippi, she's called for the state to reopen the case into her husband's murder. And today, Megger's body is being exhumed in the hope that it will offer new evidence. After Megger's coffin is raised, his body is transported to a medical facility for a second autopsy. There, medical examiners retrieve bullet fragments and give them to investigators who are once again building a case against the prime suspect in the murder, Byron Della Beckwith. Then, 6 months after the exhumation, Beckwith is arrested again. In January 1994, his third trial begins, but this time there's a key difference in the courtroom. Segregation laws no longer stop black people serving on juries in Mississippi, and 8 members of the jury in this trial are black. The prosecution presents a similar case to 30 years ago, but with several key additions. The bullet fragments recovered during the second autopsy provide extra proof that the fatal shot was fired with Beckwith's rifle. And an FBI investigator who infiltrated the Ku Klux Klan in the 1960s testifies that Beckwith boasted about killing a black man. The 71-year-old Beckwith does not take the stand in his own defense, but he does wear a Confederate flag pin, and observers take that as a sign that he's unrepentant about his racist beliefs. After 2 days of deliberation, the jury finds Beckwith guilty of murder, and the judge sentences him to life in prison. The following year, Merle Evers will be appointed chair of the NAACP, and in 2013, she will deliver the invocation at President Barack Obama's second inauguration. Merle will always say that she merely continued the work of her husband Megger, who was assassinated for his beliefs and didn't receive justice for 3 decades until Byron Della Beckwith was finally convicted for his murder on February 5, 1994. Next on History Daily, February 6th, 1934. Far-right organizations rally in Paris, creating a crisis that threatens to plunge France into a fascist revolution. From Noiser and Airship, this is History Daily. Hosted, edited, and executive produced by me, Lindsey Graham. Audio editing by Mohammed Shazib. Sound design by Molly Bach. Music by Lindsey Graham. This episode is written and researched by Jack O'Brien. Edited by Scott Reeves. Managing producer, Emily Burke. Executive producers are William Simpson for Airship and Pascal Hughes for Noiser.